Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. 50 years ago today, the news was all about the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in Dallas. All the day's other news stories became footnotes to history. One of those footnotes was a band out of Liverpool. They were called the Beatles, and America was supposed to meet them that night, November 22, 1963, in a network news piece about something called Beatlemania that was sweeping England. One week later, the Beatles released I Wanna Hold Your Hand, and as New York Times writer Alan Kozin says, everything changed. He'll join us to talk about that pivotal moment. We've also dipped into this week's news headlines. Sax player and writer James McBride won the National Book Award for Fiction yesterday, and today you'll hear him talking about that book, set in the run-up to the Civil War, and his band will play some songs of that period here in the Soundcheck studio. But as I say, today is the 50th anniversary of the JFK assassination, and we were wondering if there was a musical way to mark the occasion. That's when we got a visit, an almost fairy godmother-like visit, from WNYC archivist Andy Lancet. Andy had a vintage-looking piece of vinyl in his hand.
President Kennedy traveled by land, traveled across the sea, helped the United States and knew it was good to me. Never was a man just like President Kennedy was.
That is the Mississippi bluesman Big Joe Williams singing A Man Amongst Men, a song that he wrote immediately after the JFK assassination and recorded on an album called Can't Keep From Crying, Topical Blues on the Death of President Kennedy. It was released in 1964 on Testament Records and contains 11 songs recorded by various folk and blues artists, mostly in Chicago, in the weeks that followed that infamous day in Dallas. The blues historian Pete Welding produced the album and called these 11 songs topical blues. In the liner notes he wrote, "They are by nature short-lived, celebrating as they do transitory events. A topical song usually lasts only as long as the event it celebrates is remembered." The irony here, of course, is that this event would never be forgotten. There are a few big blues artists that were enlisted for the project. I mentioned Big Joe Williams. Another is the pianist Otis Spann, who played in Muddy Waters' band. Check out this moving song called Sad Day in Texas.
To talk, he, you know, he was on his way. No, he left home happy. No, the man, he looked so gay. No, he left home happy. My president looks so gay. When a disinteresting person put my president away,
yeah,
our President Kennedy, and I also love his wife. I feel sorry for myself. You know I feel sorry. People, I feel sorry for myself. No, we'll never have another president, and I don't want nobody else.
Sad Day in Texas, from Otis Spann, best known as the pianist in the Muddy Waters Band. You might have heard the line, "The only other man I've loved in my life is President Kennedy, and I also loved his wife." It's the 50th anniversary of the JFK assassination, and we're playing some cuts from a really interesting album called Can't Keep From Crying, Topical Blues on the Death of President Kennedy. It was originally released in 1964 and then re-released on CD in 1994. Here's a song from the husband and wife team of James and Fanny Brewer, two blind singers from the South who were based in Chicago, and they ask a question that never really has been answered. It's called, "I Want to Know Why."
John F. Kennedy was our president. We all loved him, yes we did. I won't know why, I won't know why, I won't know why. They assassinated his body in the southern land, but we know. I won't know why, I won't know why.
That's James and Fanny Brewer and a song called I Want to Know Why from the album Can't Keep From Crying, Topical Blues on the Death of President Kennedy. Playing this from a rare 1964 vinyl record. This is the original vinyl pressing on Testament Records of these songs that were written in the immediate aftermath, the few weeks right after JFK's assassination 50 years ago today. We'll spin one more track from this old piece of vinyl from our archivist Andy Lancet, unearthed here in the WNYC archives. A lesser-known musician, but just as heartfelt a piece. Mary Ross sings President Kennedy Gave His Life.
You know the Bible tells us we going to reap just what we sow. After we leave this old well, we got to face Bible God, you know. President Kennedy gave his life. Yes, he did. President Kennedy gave his life for his country, children and wives. When President Kennedy was shot down, oh, how the nation did moan. But I believe that somewhere in glory that he's living known. President Kennedy gave his life. Yes, he did. President Kennedy gave his life for his country, children and wife. God chose President Kennedy. He put a message in his heart and in his hand. God gave him the message to pass on to the people of his land. Oh, President Kennedy gave his life. God know he did. President Kennedy gave his life for his country, children and wives. Man born of a woman, there's hardships and woe. There's only one way to be born, but it's so many ways to go. Oh, President Kennedy gave his life. I know he did. President Kennedy gave his life for his country, children and wives. Jesus died on Calvary cross with nails in the palm of his hand. The president died with a bullet in his head. That was made by man. I know the President Kennedy, he gave his life. And you know he did. President gave his life for his country, his children and wife.
That is Mary Ross, a 28-year-old Chicago housewife at the time of this recording back in 1964, backed by the guitarist John Lee Granderson. The song's called President Kennedy Gave His Life. The album, which came out on Testament Records in 1964, is called Can't Keep From Crying, Topical Blues on the Death of President Kennedy. Thanks to Andy Lancet of the WNYC Archives for bringing this great old record to our attention. And just a week after the Kennedy assassination, the Beatles released I Want to Hold Your Hand. That song is the subject of a new e-book from Beatles biographer and New York Times writer Alan Kozin. He's up next. And later, James McBride, winner of this year's National Book Award for Fiction, talks about his novel, The Good Lord Bird. This is Soundcheck.
Oh, yeah, I'll tell you something. I think you'll understand when I say that something. I wanna hold your hand.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Next year marks the 50th anniversary of the Beatles' first appearance on The Ed Sullivan Show, an occasion that will be commemorated on February 9th with a special televised concert on CBS. But right before Beatlemania took hold in the States in early 1964, the band released this song, I Want to Hold Your Hand. Alan Kozen, author of a new ebook called Got That Something, argues that it was this song that changed everything. And he joins me here in the studio to talk about it. Alan Kozen, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thank you, John.
So what is it about this song that makes it such a watershed moment in the career of the Beatles?
Well, it was this song, really, that Capitol agreed to release. I mean,
in the States.
In the States. The Beatles had been recording for EMI, which, in fact, owned Capitol Records. But Capitol's attitude towards EMI product, as they would put it, was such that since they had first refusal, it was something that they
chose to refuse.
And, well, they refused absolutely almost everything that EMI sent them.
And on what basis? That it was like provincially British stuff and Americans wouldn't like it?
Well, that was their that was the reason they gave. I mean, it may also have had to do with simply not wanting to have to take what the parent company sent them. When they finally did put out an EMI recording, not by the Beatles, a bit before the Beatles, they chose some strange middle-aged lady playing piano and singing and were able to say, you see, it wasn't a hit here. But of course it wasn't going to be a hit here.
So at this point, I mean, I Want to Hold Your Hand is officially released at the end of November of 1963.
In England.
In England.
Right.
In the United States, were people, despite what Capitol was doing or not doing, were people already getting a hint of what was going on that side of the Atlantic?
Well, a little. I mean, the thing is that because Capitol had the right of first refusal, there was a deal that could be made with smaller record companies. And so Please Please Me and For Me to You came out on a little label called VJ. And She Loves You came out on a little label called Swan. And the problem is that these labels had no clout whatsoever. And while those records charted locally here and there, I mean, I think For Me to You was a minor hit in the L.A. area. The fact is most people didn't know what was going on until Walter Cronkite and David Brinkley each had a brief report in November around the time that I Want to Hold Your Hand was going to be released. The Cronkite report was actually shown the morning of November 22nd and then got preempted by the events of the rest of the day. And
the assassination,
yeah. Yeah, then he showed it on December 10th, finally.
So for folks who were paying attention, there were rumblings here and there. There were, as you say, these small label releases, which is amazing to think that the Beatles were being released on VJ Records.
That's right.
But that is, in fact, where Americans first had the opportunity to hear the Beatles and songs like this one called From Me to You.
If there's anything that you want, if there's anything I can do, just call on me and I'll send it along with love from me to you. I got everything that you want, like a heart that's oh so true. Just call on me and I'll send it along with love from me to you. I got arms that long to hold you and keep you by my side. I got lips that long to kiss you and keep you satisfied. If there's anything that you want, if there's anything I can...
The Beatles, From Me to You, released in this country on a small label called VJ Records, as Alan Kozen of the New York Times was just telling us, didn't have a whole lot of clout or distribution, so it was not the hit that we might expect in retrospect from a Beatles song in the States. Alan Kozen's new ebook is called Got That Something, How the Beatles' I Want to Hold Your Hand Changed Everything. Because, Alan, as you say, this was the song that really breaks them here in the States. Why was that so important to the Beatles or maybe to their manager, Brian Epstein?
and George Martin, their producer, they just did not want to come to the United States and fail. Cliff Richards, who was the sort of big British star before them, sort of the British Elvis, came here and really tanked. And, you know, they didn't want that to happen because, after all, I mean, their story up to this point was one of success after success after success in England and in Europe. They didn't want to come here and have that end. They wanted to be big here, too.
So at the point when I Want to Hold Your Hand is being readied for market, at least in the UK, had they already been in contact with the Ed Sullivan Show about, you know, doing the February 64?
Brian Epstein came here to New York on November 5th. Which was the day after they played the Royal Command Variety performance in England. He got on a plane. He met with Ed Sullivan here and arranged for the first Sullivan Show performances. He had already been in contact with a guy named Sid Bernstein, who died just this summer, who was a concert promoter who had been reading in the British press about the success they were having and said, we should have them, and I should be the one to present them. And he really was sort of the first American concert presenter to latch on to that. So he had arranged with Brian for them to come and play Carnegie Hall. So
two nights, right?
Well, it was one night, two shows.
Two shows. And the Beatles said, thanks, but no thanks?
Well, the Beatles, of course, actually themselves wouldn't have had any dealings with it. It was all Brian. But
right,
Brian first said, let us put this provisionally onto the books. I can't bring them over if they're not getting airplay. And then while he was here to arrange the Sullivan shows and to do some other kind of business, Capitol decided that they would release I Want to Hold Your Hand after all. Hadn't quite been released yet in Britain, but they would have had an advance of it. They would have seen what was going on in England. I mean, after a while, you can't ignore that anymore. But the whole thing was just an incredible comedy because Capitol agreed with Epstein to put the stuff out at the end of November. He went back to England. December 4th, Capitol puts out a press release saying, we're going to bring Beatlemania to America in 1964, meaning a month later. They plan to release I Want to Hold Your Hand on January 13th. Meanwhile, Cronkite plays his clip on December 10th. A girl living in Maryland writes to a DJ in Washington, Carol James, and says, why can't we hear music like this? Carol James calls BOAC and says, can you get one of your stewardesses to bring me a copy of this, of their current record?
This is a great story.
It's
BOAC
incredible.
Is now British Airways, by
right.
the way.
Yeah. So they bring him the record. He invites the girl to
the
come
studio,
on to
yeah.
his show. Mm-hmm. And she introduces the record, and they play it. The switchboard lights up. Everyone goes crazy. Now, this is December 17th, a week after Cronkite. Capitol Records, what do? They don't say, okay, we'll rush release this. They send a cease and desist order saying, stop playing it. And Carol James says, no, not only am I not going to stop playing it, he made a copy and sent it to a friend in Chicago who made a copy, a friend who was a DJ, who sent it to a DJ in St. Louis. And suddenly record stations, radio stations all over the country are playing this thing and everybody's going crazy. And Capitol finally had to bring it out on December 26th, 1963. And nothing screams, we've been forced to do this, like a record being released the day after
Christmas.
The day
after Christmas, yeah. But this was the sound that was on the airwaves that forced Capitol Records' hand.
Oh, please, say to me, let me be your man. It's such a feeling that my love I can hide. Yeah, you
Want to Hold Your Hand from the Beatles. As it turns out, there is so much to talk about with this song. Mm-hmm. Well, Alan, as you do in your ebook, Got That Something, How the Beatles' I Want to Hold Your Hand Changed Everything. But before we get too far from that clip, you tell the story of them meeting Bob Dylan and Dylan sort of bringing,
his stash
of marijuana because he just assumed that the Beatles like to get high because he thought that line was, I get high, I get high, I get high.
Right.
I'm sitting here with my headphones on. I swear it still sounds like they're singing, I get high, mm-hmm. I get high.
Yeah.
It's, I can't hide.
Right. And the
allegedly.
Question is sort of, you know, what can't they hide and why? that's the story that the Beatles always told, and I think people around Dylan have told it too. But the fact is, I mean, that was supposed to have led to their first experiences with marijuana, but it turns out Lennon and Harrison later said that they had smoked in 1960.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good story, but it's only partly true.
Alan Kozin's ebook is called Got That Something, How the Beatles' I Want to Hold Your Hand Changed Everything. One thing it did not change, and this is a point you make early on in the ebook, is that Brian Epstein and the Beatles had cottoned on to the fact that pronouns were important, that the, you know, from me to you, I want to hold your hand, that you know, for an audience of screaming teenage girls, mm-hmm. that kind of direct connection was really important.
Right.
And this is more of the same, although...
Right. It was, you know, to the degree that the Beatles can be said to follow formulas, which they kind of made a point of trying not to do, that one formula was one thing that persisted from Love Me Do until this one, which was their fifth single. I think they realized, however, I mean, after I Want to Hold Your Hand came out and they cracked the States and they were huge here and they were huge in Paris right before they came here. And they realized in Paris, particularly before they got here, that their audience was more male than female. So that was a different thing for them. And then they came here and their audience was everybody. They began to think, I think, that we don't really have to do this singing directly to the girls anymore. So if you look at their sixth single, which they actually started recording in Paris, was Can't Buy Me Love. And you could say, well, there is a me in there, but Can't Buy Me Love is a fundamentally different kind of song. It's really a more mature song. It's about, you know, love versus money and material stuff. And I think that, you know, from I Want to Hold Your Hand in a way was the end of these I'm singing to the girls songs. You know, after that, there were love songs, of course, but
right.
it was a different kind of thing.
So I Want to Hold Your Hand is the end of the beginning.
That's right.
But so you, for you, Can't Buy Me Love is the start of a kind of new brand of songwriting.
Sort of a more mature period. And you look at the back of that single, You Can't Do That, which is, you know, sheer, almost violent jealousy. They could not have put that song out a year earlier.
Let's hear a little bit of Can't Buy Me Love from the Beatles.
Can't buy me love.
The Beatles, Can't Buy Me Love. If, as Alan Kozin has been positing in his e-book called Got That Something, and here in our studio on Soundcheck today, if I Want to Hold Your Hand was a kind of landmark, you know, a big change, this is the song that changed everything, then Can't Buy Me Love is the first of the new breed of the Beatles. They're still singing. It's still the direct pronouns, you know, tell me that you don't want the kind of things that money just...
That's true.
What's different in the kind of the songwriting collaboration and perhaps in the technology? How is that sort of pre and post I Want to Hold Your Hand?
Yeah, the songwriting, actually, I Want to Hold Your Hand was also the last of the songs that John and Paul sat down and wrote to be a single together. They collaborated later on, but it was really more a question of, okay, I've got a song started and I've only got a couple of verses. You want to do it? Or, you know, it's time to do an album. We've got 12 tracks. We need 14. Let's cobble something together. This and For Me to You and She Loves You were examples of them sitting down and saying, okay, we must write the next hit. And that ended with I Want to Hold Your Hand. Then it became really a competition for who's going to get on the A side and who's going to get the B side. Mm-hmm. Technologically, it was sort of interesting because in technologically, I Want to Hold Your Hand was the beginning of the rest of their career. It was the first time they used four-track. Until then, George Martin had been using two-track recording. And you have to understand, first of all, that EMI's two-track equipment did not – it wasn't like your two-track recorder at home where you could record one track and then do the vocal on the other track. You could record the two tracks together and not separately. So if you wanted to overdub, what you would have to do is take that two-track tape, copy it to another tape while adding another your extra stuff along
right.
the way.
A technique called bouncing. And every time you bounce a tape, you
lose quality.
Right,
you
add tape hiss. So by moving to a four-track machine, it allows, and you write about this in the ebook, that it allows all those small, subtle, but telling touches, the hand claps, a doubling of just one note in the chorus and things like that.
Yeah. Now, before that, I mean, they added hand claps. I saw her standing there, for instance. The basic take doesn't have hand claps because they were busy playing their instruments. And it was worth George Martin's while to lose a tape generation to add the hand claps, he felt. But with four-track, you had a track free. This was the track layout for this song. On the first track, you have the basic rhythm of the group. You've got that's bass, John Lennon's guitar, Ringo's drums, plus George Martin's putting it through compression. So his guitar sounds almost like an organ at times. It's like doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo. The second track, George Harrison's lead guitar, just.
Okay.
Third track, all the vocals, harmony and lead. And then the fourth track they had completely free. Now, they could have, with this, also done a bouncing down thing, too. But keep in mind, you know, this is going to be a hit single, and they're a four-piece band. They have to go out and play live, so they weren't messing around too much.
Right.
So what they did on the fourth track was the hand claps. The octave leap, I Want to Hold Your Hands, up
right.
to a falsetto. Just that one falsetto note is doubled. Now, if you listen to the track that just has the vocals, it's a fine performance. It's perfectly strong. You didn't need to double it. But hearing that they did double it kind of gives you some insight into what was important to them in making the production.
And another funny thing about having all the vocals on that third track was it was possible to take that third track out and slot in a new third track.
In German.
In German, which the Beatles did not want to do,
no.
but were somehow cajoled into doing with the following results.
Oh, come on, come to me. Do next me the best time.
Komm, gib mir deine Hand, the German version of I Want to Hold Your Hand, by the Beatles, the absolute same rhythm tracks, lead guitar tracks, just the vocal track different.
Right.
Alan Kozin, music critic at the New York Times and Beatles historian, is with us on Soundcheck. His new ebook is called Got That Something, How the Beatles' I Want to Hold Your Hand Changed Everything. Was it the song, though, or was it just the right time? Because it seems like something was in the air anyway.
Oh, something was in the air, and I think it was the right time. It also, I think, happened to be the right song. But if the timing was such that it would have been She Loves You, it would have been just as crazy a time. Because after all, I mean, She Loves You, even though from the Beatles' point of view was old news and from British point of view was old news, once all those things started turning up here, I mean, I'm sure you remember people were saying, yeah, 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 you know, which is the chorus of She Loves You, just as much as you know, I Want to Hold Your Hand. And so She Loves You was huge, too. I mean, basically, VJ and Swan.
The small labels
that hadn't had hits with these things immediately reissued them. Capitol then sued them, and you know, as labels do. But, you know, all those records suddenly were everywhere.
Yeah. Now, the Beatles seem to have felt a little ambiguous about their huge hit, I Want to Hold Your Hand, because they would drop it, they would drop it from a set at the first sign of needing to cut things.
Yeah, that's my impression. You know, I mean, just looking at their set lists and at the, you know, on the 64 summer tour, a lot of those shows were recorded by radio stations or broadcast. And whenever one song was dropped, it was always I Want to Hold Your Hand.
What do you read into that?
What I read into it is, you know, we were just talking a few minutes ago about how that was the last of the songs from that old style where they're singing directly to the young girls. I have a feeling that they had outgrown that at this point. And then running into Dylan and having him think it was about something else, it just kind of reinforced for them that, like, this isn't where we're going now. This is where we were. So they played it through the summer 64 tour of North America. I mean, it was one of their big hits. They couldn't not do it. But at the end of that tour, they dropped it. They never played it again. And if you look at Paul McCartney out there touring to this very moment, and constantly reviving old Beatles songs, even going back as far as Love Me Do, he has never done I Want to Hold Your Hand.
So, wow.
Yeah.
Well, the ebook is called Got That Something, How the Beatles' I Wanna Hold Your Hand Changed Everything, including perhaps the Beatles' own impressions of their own music. Alan Kozin is the author, and he's been with us on Soundcheck. Alan, good to see you again.
Good to see you, John.
Ooh, yeah, I tell you something.
On soundcheck.org, I've been writing about some of the books nominated for this year's National Book Award. We had several authors on the show this year, including the novelist who won the award for fiction, James McBride. He joined us on Soundcheck earlier this fall for a conversation about his book, The Good Lord Bird, and he and his band played live. You'll hear it in just a moment. This is Soundcheck.
John Brown's body lies a-mouldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-mouldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-mouldering in the grave, but his soul goes marching on.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. I've known for a long time that John Brown's body lies a-mouldering in the grave. Like a lot of you, I learned this old Civil War song, sung to the same melody as the Battle Hymn of the Republic, probably sometime back in grade school. but I didn't know a whole lot about who John Brown actually was until I read the novel by best-selling author James McBride. It's called The Good Lord Bird. It's the winner of this year's National Book Award for Fiction. It is essentially a fictionalized retelling of the anti-slavery rebel's story as seen through the eyes of a rather misunderstood freed slave. Writer and musician James McBride joins me here in the studio today. James, welcome.
Oh, thank you. Nice to be here.
So, John Brown, did you know that John Brown song growing up?
It was a church song. You know, it was something we sung in church. And I knew that, and I knew faintly about him, but not much.
Yeah, I mean, I knew about the raid on Harper's Ferry, but not the sort of direct connection it had with, you know, helping to start the Civil War. Where did the inspiration for this book come from? Did it come from that song? From knowing?
No. I was monkeying around in Fredericksburg, Maryland, doing some research on a previous novel, and I saw John Brown's name mentioned, and I just decided to take a ride down to Harper's Ferry, and I was taken by what I saw. I was just fascinated by it, and I started to do some research on him, and I just thought it was a great story.
It's a pretty amazing story. This guy is possibly a lunatic. Certainly
overzealous.
Yeah. And he knows Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass, making your book, Good Lord Bird, the second novel I've read this year in which Frederick Douglass is a character, because he's also in Colin McCann's Transatlantic.
Oh, cool. Well, good old Fred.
Yeah. It seems like John Brown did know these.
Oh, yeah. He knew a lot of people. He knew Julia Ward Howe, and he knew all sorts of abolitionists. During this period, there were a lot of people who were alive. You know, Henry David Thoreau was around.
Right.
All these people knew who John Brown was. He was considered a very controversial figure. He was loved by the Northern abolitionists, and he was despised by the South. He was a white man who decided that slavery should end, and he was going to make a direct, he was going to directly try to end it himself.
Mm-hmm. Through force of arms,
Through force of arms and through arming blacks who he expected to join him in his raid on America's biggest arsenal.
And our narrator is probably around 12 years old when the action begins.
Right.
He's a boy named Henry, and for some reason, John Brown gets it into his head that Henry's a girl, and refuses to, you know, brook any kind of possibility that this could, in fact, be a boy, and the boy, Henry, just kind of goes with it.
Well, he plays with it. Yeah, I mean, John Brown kidnaps him or frees him when he goes into a tavern where Henry and his father are working.
Now, that's a little bit of a Freudian slip. You said kidnap first, because distinction between freeing the slave and kidnapping this kid is a very fine one in this book.
I think the distinction between what freedom means and what freedom really was at that time was a lot more difficult to determine now, looking back, you know, 200 years later.
Mm-hmm.
So the kid was happy. He didn't know what freedom was. He was satisfied just shoving biscuits and ale down his throat. He was living in a tavern where everybody treated him nice, and they were all a bunch of hillbillies and rebels and so forth. But when John Brown sees him for the first time, he's dressed as a slave. In those days, slave children wore potato sacks, and they just wore whatever people gave them. So John Brown just mistakenly assumes he's a girl.
Right.
And when the thing goes bad and people start shooting, Henry just decides to be quiet, and John Brown calls him Henrietta and ultimately calls him Onion.
Right.
And it's Onion who's telling us the whole story.
Right.
This book is really Onion's memoir.
And to go back to Frederick Douglass, it is a very funny book. And perhaps one of the funniest stories is Onion, who at this point is probably 13 or 14, doesn't know how old he is really,
right,
is drinking Frederick Douglass under the table because Frederick, also thinking that he is a she, is getting a little
frisky. Yeah, he wants a little bit of that, you know, equal rights, civil rights, lubrication, you know. So, yeah, it's a very funny book. It's supposed to be funny. It's supposed to be readable and presenting slavery in a way that would allow people to sort of accept the reality of it, but yet also understand the historical context in which it takes place. And in a lot of ways, you can really get to the truth better than with fiction than you can with nonfiction.
Yeah. We're speaking with James McBride, the best-selling author of The Color of Water and the new book called The Good Lord Bird. I've never met an author who takes a band on the road for his book tour. But, I mean, you've been a sax player for many, many years.
Yeah, I've been playing music a long time. You know, I worked with...
Jimmy Scott?
Worked with Little Jimmy Scott for a couple of years, and worked with Anita Baker and Grover Washington. I wrote songs for them.
Mm-hmm.
I was a musician when I wrote my first book, The Color of Water. I used to play down on Bleecker Street in New York, and, you know, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. I did all that stuff. I mean, most musicians are pretty much writers. They just don't know structure and form, you know, and most musicians don't really have the patience or the desire or the know-how to sit down and write books. I mean, some do, and, mm-hmm. you know, some of them are pretty good books and some of them aren't. But I was a journalist for 9 years after I got out of school, and then I was a musician for 9 years. And while I was a musician, I wrote my first book, The Color of Water.
And so what do you refer to yourself as now?
A writerician. No, I don't know. I mean, you know, I don't know. I'm just, I express myself with these two forms. They seem to work for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the same. It's just storytelling.
Right.
You know, it doesn't matter the form that you use, you know, if it's music or if it's literature. It's just a way of telling a story. And in this case, I thought it would be appropriate to go around with the band to do the kind of spiritual music that really inspired John Brown, because John Brown was very, very religious.
Right.
And I think people who are not religious, actually I'm fairly religious, I think people who are not religious do not understand the power that music has in terms of triggering and fostering and pushing religion into someone's soul, mm-hmm. and keeping it there.
We're speaking with James McBride, sax player and best-selling author of books like The Color of Water and Miracle at St. Anna. His latest novel is called The Good Lord Bird. It is a kind of fictionalized retelling of the tale of John Brown through the eyes of this cross-dressing young freed slave who goes by the name of Onion. And you're all here with instruments as well. So what's going to happen next?
Well, we're going to do a song... That's a very old traditional song called Standing in the Need of Prayer. But since we have our instruments, we decided to do it in a little more conventional way, you know, because we are playing in front of audiences who don't want to hear just the traditional stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So this features Keith Robinson on vocals, and it's an arrangement that we put together recently.
All right. Well, let's hear it.
All right.
James McBride is with us on Soundcheck with his band. Here's a familiar old American song, Standing in the Need of Prayer, live on Soundcheck.
It's me. It's me. It's me, oh Lord, standing in the need of prayer. It's me, it's me, it's me, oh Lord, standing in the need of prayer. My father, it's not my mother, but it's me, oh Lord, standing in the need of prayer. It's not my sister, it's not my brother, but it's me, oh Lord, standing in the need of prayer. It's me, oh, it's me, oh Lord, standing in the need of prayer. It's me. not the preacher, but it's me, oh Lord.
Standing in the need of prayer.
Standing in the need of prayer. That is James McBride on sax, Keith Robinson on guitar and lead vocals, although everybody sang there as well. Showtime Brooks behind our drum kit, Trevor Exter playing the bass, Adam Falk at the piano. James McBride, as a musician yourself, can you listen to music while you're writing?
No, I never listen to music when I'm writing. In fact, when I'm writing a book, I very rarely listen to music at all, and nothing.
So when you're faced with the blank white page, though, how do you stop your mind from just, like, going off and listening to its own music?
Usually the mortgage bill that arrives at the end of the month helps you focus.
Ah.
But I usually, you know, this book, The Good Lord Bird, was a kind of relief for me because I was going through a very painful divorce. So it was easy for me to just drop into this world and just have these adventures of the West. And I loved the wild. I loved Westerns.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was easy for me to vicariously live in this world and watch someone that I, you know, really loved and admired, John Brown, watch him do this stuff. So I didn't have any problem focusing here.
Will we be able to watch this? Has anybody optioned the book?
No, not yet. I mean, maybe they never will. But I didn't write it. I don't write books with the idea that, you know, I'm mm-hmm. writing a film.
Right.
It's just
such a cinematic story, though, from the plains of Kansas heading east and going to Harpers Ferry, where the two rivers meet.
I think it's a great American story about a uniquely great American, whether you like him or not.
Mm. And one who had a pivotal role to play in the Civil War, and of course, what would come after that?
Oh yeah, I mean, John Brown went to Europe to study how the European Napoleon and others fought their battles. He had really studied. He actually believed that he was going to be successful at Harpers Ferry
because he studied Garibaldi Hannibal. And...
Yeah, but then on the other hand, I studied Cannonball Adderley, and nobody's like, you know, my phone's not ringing.
James McBride is the best-selling author of the new book, The Good Lord Bird. It is a very funny book on top of everything else. And, James, it's been a real pleasure having you and the band here to celebrate with us today.
Well,
Thanks very much.
We were delighted to come. It's a great show. Thank you.
A bit of music there from Oscar Peterson and Milt Jackson called John Brown's Body. James McBride's novel about John Brown, The Good Lord Bird, just won the National Book Award for Fiction. You can read my blog post about The Good Lord Bird and a few other books nominated for the award, which we've featured on the show, on our website, soundcheck.org. Monday on the show, have you ever tried to introduce your parents to music that you like? How successful were you? That's what we'll be asking our guests all next week, beginning with comedian and author Rob Delaney, and we'll want to hear from you too. Call us at 866-939-1612 or post a comment at soundcheck.org. Also Monday, our series Vanished Venues returns with a look at the outrageous 80s nightclub called Area. Plus, live music from the punk bluegrass band The Devil Makes Three. Join us then. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.